So we continue with the discussion of Buddha and the teachings of Buddhism in India. We were remarking last Sunday night that we have revised our historical understanding of when Buddha lived and taught. Probably he left his body between 404 and 385 BCE. So it brings him a full century closer to us than we thought 100 years ago. It is interesting as we look at the context in which he worked, going back to the oldest documents in Pali, the language that he probably spoke or was his language was written down in. Likely he gave his sermons in Magadhi, having been himself part of that kingdom near Rajagriha. He was influenced by a number of spiritual teachings in his years wandering as a shramana, as a monk, as a renouncer of the world. But likely, even when he was a prince in his father's kingdom, he was receiving some spiritual instruction. None of this would have been new to him. But quickly, he mastered a number of meditative techniques which were current at that time. Probably he practiced some of the asceticism of the Jain school. Even though he was a contemporary of Mahavira, he might have been a few years older than Mahavira, but Mahavira predeceased him. Mahavira was perhaps the last in the lineage that counted 24 teachers, but certainly more teachers than just him were part of that Jain tradition. I mention it because a good deal of Buddha's analytics, his dialectics, his argumentation is directed against opposing schools and the Jain's figure on occasion. We think of Buddhism, we think of the doctrine of no self, the doctrine of samsara, the doctrine of suffering. But to get to the core of what Buddha thought, we need to understand, following Richard Gombrich in this, how important the concept of karma is. In Vedic contexts, which we've been looking at, the Rig Veda and then what followed the Rig Veda in the Upanishads and even into the Gita, karma begins as a concept, which simply means act and comes to mean ritual act. It is particularly associated with the conduct of the sacrifice. And through the sacrifice, if you remember, the world is put right. The world exists, continues to exist, because the sacrifice is done. The Brahmins are the priests who conduct the sacrifice and so are an important liaison in maintaining the order of the worlds. Buddha takes the term karma from its literal meaning into a metaphorical meaning. He describes it as being an inner action. And if, in a sense, we are to participate in this kind of offering, then it ought to be internal to us. It ought to be a psychological act. More, if what we are is a consequence of action, if we have somehow arrived in our current position because of other actions that we have taken, and if how we behave now will influence where we go in the future, if there is impact to be made, then is it of an absolute kind, or is it altogether irrelevant? We have to know this. The Buddha, as in all things in this too, describes a middle way, a path down the middle. Because it is not every act that counts as karma for us. Because much of what we do is done through us. It's just motivated by other causes around us, moving through us, whatever us is. What we are responsible for is what we intend. So if we intend poorly, that is something that we carry. That certainly will have a fruit with. Now, this idea of karmic fruit has a real point, because you plant a seed and it starts to grow and you don't know what's coming up. You're not paying attention. You're going off and doing something else. And all of a sudden, that seed has become a plant. That plant has matured and has given a fruit. And there's the fruit of your action. You've already forgotten about it. But it's come along, unseen to you. And just so is the chain of karma that leads to our recognition of what's going on. So the karmic inheritance that we have may be determinative of a future state, but it's right squarely in front of us what we want to do about it. And the first thing we have to do is to understand what all this is with a straight look. We have to be able to see things as they are. And here Buddha steps away from reliance on ritual. And as India's first, perhaps greatest psychologist, demands that we examine what we are. And if we look at what we are, at what this chain of karma has brought us to be, if we examine it, we see that we are not one thing, we're a bunch of things. We're an aggregate. This influence, that element, this element, all of it coming together. So that when we examine the self that we think we are, we find it to be conditioned, that it hasn't arisen absolutely out of a void, but that it is an event which has occurred with streams coming from every side and then pushing on beyond. So Buddha, in describing that we are in samsara, a wheel of existence which is driven by karma, and that we have no self, is trying to tell us essentially that all is process. Everything is process. He did not have the word for process in those days with that language, but that's what he's trying to describe. Does it mean that we don't exist absolutely, that there's nothing here, only a void? That's not his point. If he were arguing that, he wouldn't be saying that we have to break out of this chain, which leads us to constant rebirth and constant redying. Rebirth, redeath, rebirth, redeath. There is something that continues, but it continues so long as the universe continues because it's part of the universal flux. This thing is not eternal. This thing is not existent. Buddha steps away from the Upanishads and says, we divorce this idea of existence from this idea of consciousness. You might be conscious. That does not mean that you exist as an eternal, absolute thing. Because where is this thing? Show me this thing. Constantly, we are subjected to the vicissitudes of nature. We are born, we're young, we mature, we grow old, we pass away. These states are not necessarily successive. They can all exist in us at one time. So the idea that we see in Buddha recalls what we learned in the Sankhya philosophy, where the Purusha, the soul consciousness, is abstracted from all this natural play. And all this is going on and going on, but none of it is really deliberative. None of it is conscious. It's just mechanical. It's the play of nature. So Buddhism, some say, is the Sankhya philosophy without Purusha. Just Prakriti, no Purusha. That's a little simple. That's asking Buddha to make a metaphysical determination, and he would not do that. One of his famous examples of why it's silly to deal with these questions is that if somebody has shot you with an arrow, and the doctor has come to work on you, and you insist on knowing first who made the arrow, and then who shot the arrow, we'll never get around to saving your life. You only have so much time. So it's better to go ahead and take the medicine. And the medicine here is to recognize that this samsara that we're involved in leads to suffering, dukkha. But there is cessation to suffering. And there is a path that leads to the cessation of suffering. And that path is the Eightfold Path. And it breaks down into three general divisions. The first, dealing with wisdom. Right views. See things as they are. Based upon that right view, then right intention. Act in the right way. Following upon the Jain doctrine that we will not hurt anything, but from an inner side. The Jains would say ahimsa, non-injury, absolutely. Anything that you do, any action that you undertake harms something. So the best thing is not to act at all. But Buddha says no. Again, that misses the point. You have in your consciousness not to hurt a sentient creature. And by the way, Buddha did not believe that plants were sentient. So you could, in essence, harm plants. When forced by public pressure to retreat from that position, he retreated and said, yes, yes, we should not harm plants. Wink. He missed that one. So those were the first two. And then, of course, there's the ethical division of the Eightfold Path. You have to be careful of what you say, because what you say should reflect truth. Now, Buddha didn't mean to say only pleasant things. If you've read his sermons, you can see he was quite sharp. He could be gently contradictory to his opponents, but he was also to be feared. He calls himself a Jina, a victor at some point, because of all the people he's defeated in argument. And he used sarcasm, that most terrible of weapons, the nuclear device in argumentation, whenever he felt it necessary. So, right speech. Following upon that is right action. And action, again, is what you intend to do, based upon your right view of things. And upon right action, of course, right livelihood, because you have to live a life that is consonant with your higher goals, not to hurt and to escape this field of suffering. Right livelihood, that's interesting. We're going to take a little path away for a moment and look at what's going on in India at this time. Buddha comes from a part of India which was the easternmost edge that Vedism had reached at that point. He's the son of a king, but his kingdom may have been something like an oligarchy. And it might even have had an elected king. So Buddha may not have been guaranteed a position simply being the son of the father who was the king. But there was an idea of pluralism that was present there. And without adherence on a priestly class to govern their action. What is also going on about this period is a second urbanization, what they call the first urbanization was Mohenjo-Daro and Harappa. We don't know where they came from or where they went. We'd like to see if they have Aryan origins. We don't know. But after they begin to pass out of existence, there is no real urban life. Everything is a pastoral, agricultural mix across the north of India until about now. So what begins to happen is that there are some agricultural advances. A vast hydrological system is being put into place, and the three or four classes in India, the Varna system, the Brahmins, the priesthoods, obviously they can't be very numerous, because if they would, how could you pay them all? And the second group, the Kshatriyas, how many warriors could there be in an agronomic culture? So most people were probably Vaishyas, the producers, those who produced wealth. These are the people who begin to move into farming with advanced water usage and start growing crops which they can sell, and where they're able to sell these crops, cities start to arise and flourish. And this city life on that eastern edge is where Buddha begins teaching. And what he's telling these newly wealthy, independent farmers is that their future depends on them, not on whether they pay the tithe to a Brahmin to conduct a sacrifice or not. Rather, that it's how you act. It's how you behave. What's going to happen to you depends on how many points you score on the merit side of things. So this is a very big difference. the early kingdoms that come into being around the time of Chandragupta Maurya are not related to the Brahminical kingdom coming with Vedism from the west and northwest. Chandragupta, for instance, as we mentioned last week, was himself a Jain. Ashoka, his grandson, becomes a Buddhist. And how do the Buddhists like to travel? They like to travel from city to city with tradesmen who are going to sell their agricultural products, the handicrafts they're making. So this is a newly liberated economic class that's going out abroad in India, and who gets to ride with them? State-sponsored, but the Buddhists. And so where the Jain religion had an early demise, you might say, or at least a downturn in its numbers, Buddhism, with a somewhat more popular message, because who wants to be naked all the time and starve yourself to death? Buddha's idea that you adopt a middle way, not too much food, not too little food. The porridge has to be just right. Is a very attractive idea to somebody who doesn't want to have to give his wealth over to a Brahmin. Now, the weakness in that is that Buddhism becomes city-centered. And out in the rural areas, Brahmanism continues to thrive. And those people believe that if I pay the priest, then they will do the sacrifice, which will continue the cycle of existence, and good things will come. Now, the way I'm speaking about Brahmanism right now is with sort of the down look that Buddhism will give it. We've talked till now about how the Vedic religion has an inner dimension, an inner significance, how the Upanishads are a rich tradition of wisdom, and even Buddha seems to acknowledge that and has some things to say which are almost a dialogue with what he knows from the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad or the Chandogya Upanishad. So I don't want to surrender the spiritual heritage of the ancient Aryans. I'm just presenting what Buddha probably met in the social streams that he was swimming in then. So I think we've interrupted to go in going through the Eightfold Path, having described the right conduct that we must have in speech, action, and livelihood. Our livelihood should reflect our values. And then, of course, there is concentration. First, effort. This is not unknown to the Upanishads. Tapasya is a key word in the Vedic religion, but also for the Buddhist, right effort must be present. If you want to escape this samsara, if you want to dissolve this fictional person that you think you are, which is really a bundling up of karma in an unending process, then what you must do is apply yourself. You must sit. And then you must become mindful. You must develop an insight, a penetrating insight that cuts through all of this nonsense and sees that behind all of this, there is no permanent eternalist sort of self there. The Buddhist position eventuates in a state of deep concentration. You become master of the four states of meditation. Now this Buddha may not have taught. Those four states of meditation may be subsequent to Buddha's life, but crept in. as I mentioned last week, and which bears repeating. When he had an advanced practitioner with him, he would sit and simply have a conversation and give him tips about how to get over and around a hurdle, how to break out of the process, how to attain the experience of nirvana. And for the Buddha, attaining this blowing out of the fictional self did not necessarily mean the eradication of consciousness. He would not speak about that. Because if you get drawn into this dialectic of is or is not, then you're pulled towards that eternalism, or you're pulled towards that relativism, and neither can really describe what is real. So he prefers not to touch that. But what he's interested in doing always is getting you to experience this truth. He wants you to sit. He wants you to look within. He wants you to plunge into the depths of what is here and see that, I am free from this complex. And in that is bliss, a supreme bliss. And who achieves that is an arahant, one who has conquered, one who has achieved. Now, in later times, achieving arahatship is not enough. Another distinction is made. Although Buddha was satisfied to call himself an arahat, one who had achieved nirvana, later people said about him that no, he had bodhi, he had enlightenment. He was not simply released from this through the experience of nirvana. He went beyond nirvana into a sheer experience of bodhi, of light. This is not a distinction Buddha ever made. But since we're at this door now, I think we can talk a little bit about the history of Buddhism or Buddhist teaching in India after he left his body. There was a council. They decided what the rules of the order would be, how they would discipline themselves, what his basic teaching was, and there was lots of disagreement. Of course, this was echoed a couple of centuries later in the Near East. So this is sort of a prologue. It seems to happen wherever we have people. A second council was held, and then a third council around the time of Ashoka, who of course was a great patron of Buddhism, puts up the Rock Edicts, some of the earliest writing that we have about Buddhist doctrine. And at this third council, we begin to see a division emerging. Not so much that they are different orders of Buddhism, but there is one group which says, no, I'm going to stick with what I know. This is what Buddha taught. This is the simple stuff. And we're going to work on that. And they're called Theravada. And then there's another group, Mahasanghika, which eventually becomes the Mahayana school. And at this point, they don't dress differently. They don't do anything differently. They just feel that there is farther that we can go. There's more that we can do than simply aiming at our individual salvation. We can work towards the enlightenment of all. We find that the distinctions among these schools become sharper as time goes on and become divisive and argumentative with a certain bite. The Theravada school is one of direct realism by Bhashika. Is the idea that what you experience is really there. You're experiencing exactly what is there. And that's what you need to see through to get your liberation from it and experience nirvana. The South Tantrika school arises to criticize this early Theravada school of philosophy and says that in fact these dharmas that you think you experience as the fundamental elements of reality that you think that you're experiencing directly, you cannot, because Buddha taught us that things arise independent origination, that everything depends upon everything else. And if that is true, then the unseen cause behind the thing that you're experiencing is unseen, undetected. So how can you say that you're truly experiencing that? You don't even know if it's there. And so this is a sort of a bridge to a later philosophy, but allows us to get over to the Mahayana school, where we meet the Madhyamikas led by Nagarjuna, who may be the greatest philosopher in all of Indian thought, but certainly the equal of Shankara, whom titularly is the greatest philosopher of all time. And what Nagarjuna suggests is that these things that the Saptantrikas are talking about that lie behind the event and can't be detected, beyond our apperception, because we can't see the thing in itself or the merits or demerits that went into causing the thing that we can't see, may as well not exist at all. For all the proof that you can bring to the fact that you say they are, you can't prove that they are. Nor can you prove that they are not. So it's an analysis which is withering. It's withering because it destroys both sides of any argument. And this becomes a dialectic that is picked up by lots of philosophers from then on, because it reduces everything to basically an indeterminate. You can't say anything about it. It may as well be void, shunya. And so this is the school of shunyata, of voidness. It follows upon the suchness of Ashwagosha, but this becomes the most powerful argument in all of Buddhist thought. There is another school that arises, however, which says, you're saying that we can't say that anything exists, whether it's an eternalist proposition or a nihilist proposition. But the one thing we can be sure of is consciousness, because you have just made a conscious argument. And if you say that that consciousness can't make a real argument, then your argument, following its own force, is false and destroys itself. So what we have to say is that all things depend upon consciousness. This is a school of idealism, Yogacara. So that if there is reality at all, it is because something is conscious of it. So what is that something? We can't say. But you see, We have come full circle now. Buddhism, which was saying you can't say that there is anything that is eternal, now must posit some kind of consciousness of which all of this is the object of that consciousness. So philosophically, we've come 360 degrees or 180 degrees. Somebody help me. So, there's a great deal more to say. I have given short shrift to this, but if we followed the dialectic out, it would be an evening just in itself, but it would be a logical wonderland. You would really love that. You'd finally find that you love logic when you follow the Madhyamika strand out. Buddhism continues to develop in India. After the Yogacara school, there's the Tathagatagarbha school, which even more powerfully presents that there is a reality beyond the senses, a conscious being, and in a sense you're reaching a kind of Vedantic Godhead with this. Those of you who have read D.T. Suzuki's Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism recognize how he treats the Dharmakaya, the body of the Dharma, as being a kind of cloud of sheer consciousness in which all potentialities exist and which rain down into existence. We're back to the Vedantic conception then, and then back to a kind of panentheism where that divinity, whatever that Buddha nature is beyond the world, outside all things which are transitional, beyond and behind the appearances, and yet somehow embodied in it. If Nagarjuna canceled out both sides of every argument, saying that nirvana and samsara are the same thing, and samsara and nirvana are the same thing, either side of the proposition that you look at, this school goes even farther in that direction. And then, last arising in India is the Vajrayana, the school of the lightning, the school of the thunderbolt, which is an esoteric style of Buddhist thinking, which gets transported to preserve itself to Tibet when the Muslim hordes come in and begin conquering North India, etc. And of course, had centuries of development. There it gets mixed with the Burn religion in Tibet, and we have a wholly new thing in Tibetan Buddhism. But still, it's part of the Vajrayana school. So there's a lot of history here, and much to look into. But it all comes back, doesn't it, to Buddha's basic tenet, which is, look at yourself, examine yourself, and you will find that the thing that you believe is there is really arising as the result of so much that went beyond. And all that's going on behind will come to fruition and pass away and lead to other things. Now, if you want to be part of that endless chain of causation, go ahead, but I can offer you a way out. This fourfold path, the four noble truths that lead to the noble eightfold path is what will deliver you from all harm and evil. Because Buddhism, in a sense, deals with the end of things. It is ironic that they are closely associated with the rites of death. Often in literature you find that examples are given of how they attend to the one who is dying, how they attend to the one who is departed, how they put the hungry ghost to rest, dealing with the pretas, or the peta in Pali, fills the annals. Of course, even if you look at the Jataka tales, the tales of the birth of Buddha, it always ends with his death. Every Jataka tale ends with his death. And then he goes on his way, ever striving forward to become a fully enlightened one, to become a Buddha, having taken that resolution. But always going through death. Death is a door that leads you out of the world, and then you're led back in. If I can beg you to permit me one more thing. When we were talking about karma, we didn't talk specifically about rebirth. Obviously, rebirth is part of Buddha's idea, and even though it's not an eternal soul that is reborn, there is some substantive seed or droplet which continues en route. Now, there has been an idea for all of modern scholarship that there was no rebirth known to the Rig Veda. And recent scholarship by Joanna Jurowicz has turned that on its head, going to the 10th mandala. I think it's maybe the 15th hymn, or the 16th hymn, and you go to the 5th verse, you can see that if that thing is translated correctly, actually, Agni is being called upon to go up into heaven, having where the soul is resting and enjoying and feasting with his fathers, the Pitru. And once there, Agni is supposed to take that soul and conduct him back to earth so that he is reborn. So there is a direct reference in the Rig Veda to rebirth. But the idea is not that there are several states that one can go to. You're either going there or here, over and over again. So with Buddhism, there's a little bit more analysis of what is the nature of rebirth and a carving out of different worlds, you know, and some worlds are where there are ghouls. Well, we needn't go through all of that cosmology because it's, number one, it's not certain that Buddha really taught it. Number two, if he taught it, it might have been a joke that he was taking a current cosmology that the Brahmins were promulgating and just turned it on his head and make him look like laughingstocks. So the Buddha was a great joker. People didn't know how to take him, but he clearly had a sense of humor. So this is our quick dash through Buddhism. Next week, I'm torn between taking up Shankara or taking up the Yoga Sutra, but I think I'm going to take up Shankara because some of what we've just looked at in the late Mahayana school of the Madhyamika was something that Gaudapada, Shankara's forebear in that lineage, dealt with directly and was strongly influenced by. So I think we may as well continue in that light. And then we may do the Yoga Sutras, or we may continue, having talked about Shankara, and go straight to Ramanuja. And then come all the way back to the Yoga Sutras in a few weeks. Unless you have an objection. So, I'm anxious to hear your questions if you have any.